Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti.
Ladies and gentlemen, today we have a very special Warner Archive Collection podcast. We have a guest in person in the studio. He is a returning guest and one of the great allies of the Warner Archive Collection who has contributed heart, soul, and passion to so many things that we've done. We want to welcome Jerry Beck back to the hallowed halls of Warner Brothers in Burbank at this special Warner Archive Collection podcast where we salute films not made at Warner Brothers. They are films that were made in Culver City by a guy named Tex Avery who used to work at Warner Brothers and made amazing animated short films that really are in a canon all their own, and that's what we're here to talk about. There is a new Blu-ray we have lovingly and carefully assembled from new 4K scans from the best surviving elements. We have Tex Avery Screwball Classics, Volume 1, with 19 original Tex Avery MGM cartoons, uncut in their original uncensored form, and they span a pretty large gap of Tex Avery's, I'd say, first decade at MGM. We don't go too late in the chronology. Jerry, welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here.
I love being here. I love what Warner Archive does, and I love Tex Avery, and I love cartoons. So
the last time that you were here, we were talking about the Popeye Blu-rays that we were starting with Volume 1 of the Popeye cartoons made at Paramount in the 1940s that were in Technicolor and then, of course, later in Polycolor and Cinecolor. But you helped us launch those series of releases. And before that, you came to talk about Porky Pig 101, which was a DVD set, and the cartoons weren't remastered. It was an attempt by us to gauge the sensitivities and the sensibilities of the audiences out there to support classic animation. They showed up. We came back with Popeye in pristine condition on Blu-ray. And now we're moving on to something we've been wanting to do for almost 20 years because we didn't ever get to really do this on DVD. So it's made the leap from Laserdisc, the last time we really did something that was Tex Avery oriented.
Yeah. And VHS.
And VHS before that, which I was going to get to in a moment, because that is really where it starts.
I know where you're going now.
Now you know where I'm going. But we have this Blu-ray, which is the byproduct of new 4K scans from the best surviving elements of each cartoon. And there's a story behind that, that unlike the Popeye cartoons, where by and large the original nitrate negatives have been carefully and lovingly preserved, the same can't be said for most of the Tex Avery cartoons because tragically MGM, with good intentions, MGM sent their nitrate camera negatives to a facility on the East Coast that takes care of nitrate, and it's a wonderful archive, but they were unfortunately subjected to a tragic fire in the late 1970s that took out the original negatives of a great deal of the shorts and cartoons made by MGM, as well as 200 feature films.
Aye.
So in many cases, we don't have the original negative to go back to, but what we have been doing as the company is embarking on a massive preservation undertaking, as we have found the elements for the cartoons and started scanning the best elements, including some successive exposure master cartoons.
Right.
Which are, in most cases, maybe a second-generation copy of the original negative. The results have been outstanding and really quite remarkable. So this set spans, I believe, from 1943 up through, I believe, the late 40s or early 50s.
Right.
I'm not exactly remembering what the chronology is, but the point is this was not a chronological set and not a comprehensive set. This is a volume one of what will be several volumes of Tex Avery cartoons made at MGM during the 1940s and 50s. So as they are being preserved, that is only half the battle. It then comes to us to finish the job by carefully remastering these cartoons, cleaning them up with the intention of removing debris and damage to the film, but not getting rid of cell anomalies and things that were part of the original photography, so that you'll see the cartoon the way people did when it was first shown on a theater screen back in the 40s, which includes cell dust or cell irregularities because somebody didn't clean off the prior cell or what have you. But you've never seen them look this good. And Jerry has the Blu-ray. I don't think it's in his hand right now.
Oh, it's very close by.
But it is now in his hand.
I have it in my hand.
And we wouldn't even go as far as to say let the presses roll without Jerry looking at the test disc before we turned on the production line to make sure each disc gets pressed properly. And the Blu-rays were manufactured because we needed his seal of approval and to know that we had done the job right.
He has to approve each and every one, right? That comes off the...
We will sell no wine before it's time.
Yes, I'm so put my initials on each disc.
Yeah.
We're very grateful for everything that you do to support our efforts, and to have you here in the studio to talk about Tex Avery is really quite a pleasure.
These are jewels. I've said this before about Warner Brothers cartoons, but these are absolute gems. As I get older, more and more I can support and stand by the statement that these Tex Avery cartoons and a majority of the Warner Brothers cartoons are, to me, as, a classic, I'm just going to say, classic as Casablanca, Citizen Kane, Gone with the Wind.
They just happen to be short and animated.
Yeah, they have short and animated. We should always say that all of those cartoons, the Warner cartoons, and certainly these MGM cartoons, and the Popeyes, these were intended for grown-ups in theater audiences. I mean, when I say intended for grown-ups, I don't mean that kids couldn't watch them. It's just that they weren't aimed at children.
These are not episodes. That's
true.
These were short films that were released over a theater season. And theater seasons did go from the fall into the summer like television seasons. And each fall, the studios would announce what their lineup of shorts and cartoons would be, along with their features that were planned. And it was part of the studios owning theaters and needing to fill the programming in the theaters. And so most of the major studios all had cartoon departments. Not all of them, but most of them did.
Most of them did. Even the ones that didn't have them under their own roof. Let's say Fox, for example.
With Terrytoons. That was exactly
Independent studio, right. But most of them did. They all really had some affiliation one way or another. It was demanded by audiences from the beginning of at least talking films. Cartoons were around in the silent era, but when Mickey Mouse in the 1930s, patrons pretty much demanded a cartoon with their show. It's kind of like when I go to the movies today, if I feel cheated if I walk in late or if, God forbid, the theater doesn't run the trailers in advance, I'd feel like, wait, I'm not getting my money's worth. That's how people felt about cartoons. I mean, I don't think they felt that way necessarily about the comedy shorts or a travel.
No.
But they felt that way about the cartoons, and that's why every studio had to do that. I think if I had to rack my brain, I guess the only real studio would be United Artists that sort of, over the years, had some affiliations here and there with animators. But mainly, every studio had a cartoon affiliation, every one of them.
And ironically, the last studio to still put cartoons in theaters was UA
in the
70s with those DePatie Freleng shorts.
Yeah, that's strange.
Even like Mr. Jaws.
I like to point out.
They were terrible, but it didn't matter.
I'll keep this on point and on subject, but the reason that the DePatie Freleng cartoons were picked up by United Artists and were kept going for so long, the reality is that they had picked up the AAP collection in the 50s, Popeye and pre-48 Warners, made so much money with that on television. They wanted more. They wanted their own. And the DePatie Freleng Pink Panther was that. That's why they enthusiastically did that.
And they kept them in theaters until you started working at UA.
The early 80s. The last release of those is the early 80s, and I was there.
That's right.
You just explained a mystery from my childhood.
And that is what?
Well, I just always
the pathway
wondered
from the theater to TV for those cartoons. Because yeah, it's always a little confusing.
No, like, nobody,
most people, I think most of the average person on the street, if they even are conscious of cartoons other than, Rick and Morty. But, I mean, if you're looking at older, you talk about older cartoons, they don't realize that they were made for theaters. Right. Most people don't know that.
Right. And
we've been trying to educate them for the last 30 years about that.
Right. But in recent years, again, I know we're talking a little off subject, but really we're not. But in recent years, the last 10 years or 15, 20 years, when Pixar's been releasing little shorts with their films, they're done obviously to the budgets and the quality of their feature films. If you really look back at these shorts, the MGM shorts, the Warner Brothers shorts, the Paramount shorts, they've got what I call A-level budgets. They're actually pretty high. They're not cheap. Now, there were other studios that were, Terry Toons, for example. But but these other studios, particularly the MGMs, they were trying to compete. They were competing with Disney in their minds. That's what they were trying to do. That's why the Happy Harmonies are very much like
the Silly Symphonies. Yeah.
They were really trying. And then, of course, the switch over in the 40s to the more Warner Brothers style humor, and they finally succeeded by actually having stars like Tom and Jerry and having Tex Avery as the back. What a fantastic studio that MGM studio was.
Yeah, it's particularly sad that their legacy was relatively short in terms of the duration of it, because through the 30s, you had really, it really wasn't until the simultaneous launch of Tom and Jerry, kind of by accident, in 1940, with Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera, and then Tex Avery moving from Warner Brothers to MGM, that the MGM cartoon department really exploded into something magnificent.
Yes.
And they were putting out, in my opinion, the Warner Brothers cartoons and the MGM cartoons of the 40s especially have something that most of the other studios didn't have, and especially Disney didn't have it.
Right.
And that is wonderful humor.
Yeah.
Wonderful comedy that holds up even today.
Right. But I want to say something about Tex Avery, which I sometimes think about, because that's the way when you're a cartoon nerd, you speculate on what if this happened or this didn't happen.
Right.
I wonder what would have happened if Tex Avery didn't come to to MGM, because the Tom and Jerry cartoons, they were fantastic. The Tom and Jerry were stars by the time Avery shows up about 2 years into that. But you can see the Avery influence coming into the Tom and Jerry cartoons, and they're really picking up a lot of things. The facial expressions, the crazy, poses, and, when the characters get hit over the head and they turn into something, that's very Avery. And they've acknowledged they were influenced
and
by
what
Avery.
What did they all share in common?
The Scott Bradley
there
music.
There you go.
Yes. Which is brilliant. I love the music in these things.
I mean, this is maybe overstating it a little bit, but, I mean, the fact of the matter is, when people talk about a cartoon character, what they mean by cartoon character really is a Tex Avery cartoon character.
Yeah. It's funny. I just posted on my Facebook page, somebody found a movie ad for Wonder Man playing at the Laugh movie on 42nd Street. Did you know what the Laugh movie was?
Yeah.
It was the Empire. It became the Empire Theater, which is now the AMC 25. Anyway, but I digress. They only showed comedy films on that 42nd Street theater.
It had been a legitimate theater
yes,
before that.
It was that. That's true, of course. And the ad says Wonder Man, and it says playing with Tex Avery in Northwest Hounded Police. Tex Avery in. Not Droopy.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. For me, the real crux of Tex getting his proper attention, at least, from my vantage point as a kid, was when the Joe Adamson book came out.
Right. What happened was this, and this is my memory. We're about the same age. Okay, so this is going to date us a little bit. I remember when I was a little kid, wasn't there a show called like Johnny 7 on ABC?
Oh, yeah.
We're New Yorkers, everybody.
Right.
And I believe that show ran, I think, what I call the pre-48 MGM package that does not contain Tom and Jerry. There was such a thing.
Oh, yeah.
There was a package that was the other cartoons like Barney Bear, Tex Avery, and I think Captain and the Kids, and all the non-stuff.
Right.
And probably even the Happy Harmonies. And I have a childhood memory of the wolf and the eyes coming out of your head and the crazy stuff. A childhood memory. It's like this weird, it's been in there.
That was a syndication cartoon.
This is like 1960 or something, right? Or 61 or something like that. Then I don't remember seeing those cartoons whatsoever.
They vanished, but what happened was that all the cartoons were basically sold into television in one form or another from each studio around 55, 56. And right. Disney did it with the Mickey Mouse Club for their stuff. Right. But everybody else kind of made their stuff available. MGM held back Tom and Jerry.
Yes, they did.
And it did so because the cartoons were making so much money in the theaters and they could reissue them. They also held back Droopy. Because when they finally took the gamble of making the sale in 1965 of the Tom and Jerry show to CBS for Saturday mornings,
right.
there'd be a Droopy cartoon in the middle
right.
of a Tom and Jerry cartoon bookending it. And some of the Averys popped into Tom and Jerry on CBS. Oh. But it really wasn't, you know, in the New York market. It really wasn't until WPIX got the MGM cartoon package and we started right. seeing...
That was like when? The late 70s. Like 78 or 77.
35 millimeter prints.
Beautiful. I remember that.
Yeah. And it was...
Although I got to tell you, why I would do this, but I recently was going, like, I'm going to throw away VHS tapes I have. I kind of don't. People are making me. And I found the original first release... of Tom and Jerry on CBS home video.
Right.
Right?
Part of the first 12 MGM releases on VHS and Betamax in October of 1980, Wizard of Oz, Network, 2001 A Space Odyssey, and there was that. Tom and Jerry.
Right. And I put it in to look at it. Oh my God. The print quality is horrendous. It looks
now
like 16 millimeter splicey prints.
Yeah.
They were putting out if to buy on this VHS. 16 millimeter. They weren't 35. They
awful. I have copies of the... They're done on Ditto paper, too, which is really cool. Huh. I have copies of those purchase orders.
And
really?
How much were those?
Yeah, that's a good question.
VHS?
A lot of
$59.98.
$59 to buy how many?
This is when
it was like eight.
Eight cartoons.
Yeah, it was like eight cartoons.
And then I see people, you know, today complaining, a Blu-ray for $20. Oh, my God, this is robbery.
Yeah.
People just are clueless.
Right, right. But not to mention if you were to somehow find an illegal 16-millimeter print, that would cost you a lot.
$125 or something like that. Yeah. But the thing I want to talk about with Tex Avery is Joe Adamson wrote his book
right.
about Tex Avery in the mid-70s, and at the same time, a company that I worked for at one time that is no longer in existence called Films Incorporated
right.
that had the 16-millimeter non-theatrical rights to MGM's library started marketing Tex Avery cartoons to colleges.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they put together packages of three cartoons, not unlike what you did, Jerry, when you went to UA16.
Yes.
And you put together packages of cartoons that actually were attractive to the animation historian. Because before then, some jerk would just throw three cartoons right. together on a reel and say, Cartoon Parade number 22.
Right,
and it
exactly.
would just be, it would have no relevance whatsoever. Jerry helped to design a catalog
yeah.
at United Artists 16 based around their cartoon holdings that included some of the cartoons that we can't show today.
Yes. that might have been the last time they made
prints
of those.
And I don't think anybody was aware that those cartoons were still being sold to the college market at the time. At Films Incorporated, there were some dedicated Avery fans who really went out and marketed directly to the college film societies packages of Tex Avery cartoons. That was the beginning. And that was convincing people that Tex Avery wasn't a Western film star,
right.
that Tex Avery was an animator. And, you know, ironically, at that time, his last work that he was involved in, because
right.
he passed away around
right.
that time,
right. 1980.
Quickie Koala Show.
Right.
You know, was the last thing he had any hand in developing. He died very young.
A release.
Relatively
right,
young.
Relatively.
Relatively
yeah.
young.
Yeah.
and didn't really live to see the resurgence of popularity and interest in his cartoons.
He didn't, but I know that a lot of friends, including people like Adamson and others who worked with him at Hanna-Barbera, who are younger people then, have told me they interviewed him, they expressed their love to him. He knew that there was a younger generation discovering it, but it was insular, but he was aware.
You know, to get back to the aegis of how, why don't you talk a little bit about how Tex Avery got his start in animation, his time here at Warner Brothers, what he did here at Warner Brothers, and his arrival at MGM.
Tex was a cartoonist, then was a cartoonist in high school. That's where everybody in his high school would use the expression Doc. That was kind of a local thing. Hey, Doc, what are you doing, Doc? And that worked right. its way into the cartoons, famously, as we now know. And if you look at a lot of Avery pre-Bugs Bunny, pre-Wild Hare, you'll see he used this, the characters addressing each other as Doc. That was a thing he did. He came out to California. I guess he did some comic strips, but basically ended up at Universal for Walter Lantz, being a gag man, being an animator on those Oswald the Lucky Rabbit cartoons from the Universal at that time. Those of us who know that and see he gets credit, Fred Avery, on those. And if you look carefully at some of them, boy, oh boy, there's some trademark Avery things happening there. You kind of know. There's one cartoon, one cartoon where one of these 1930s Oswalds, where Oswald's in the forest and he walks off the background and you suddenly see the names of the animators on white space. And he's like, oh, I've gone too far, so it's Tex Avery. And he moves back.
That's like the Technicolor Ends Here joke in Lucky Ducky.
He was already doing that kind of, you know, breaking the fourth wall. Right. I know this is a cartoon, you know, meta thing already at that time. He hears of an opening. Warner Brothers, meaning Leon Schlesinger's studio of the 30s, was having its difficulties. Harmon and Ising left. Schlesinger, who I think was a great producer, because he left the animators alone, but he really didn't know much about cartoons.
But he wasn't like Quimby or Seltzer.
Right. He wasn't. But then again, he wasn't really the visionary to put together a studio. He left it in the hands of artists who did know. That was a good thing. Thing is, Disney was working on Snow White. I mean, there was a lot of competition at that time. He got a lot of leftover people. He got leftover people from Harmon and Ising's studio, including Friz Freleng. And Friz became his senior director. But he had a major opening for directors and new talent around 1935-36. And that's where Carl Stalling comes in, Mel Blanc comes in, and Tex Avery and Frank Tashlin come in. It's like the perfect storm
Animators like McKimson and Jones and Clampett.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, Clampett and Jones, I believe, were there as smaller level animators, but they gravitated toward these new guys who suddenly came in with the director job. I mean, the story is that Avery sort of BS'd his way into, you know, he claimed directorship of these Oswald cartoons. You know, Schlesinger said, why not, and gave it to him. But you know what? It's a catastrophic, or if that's the right term, decision. Not catastrophic, that wouldn't be the right term, but it was a major monumental. But maybe accidental monumental decision. You know, they had a lot of freedom. I mean, I think Schlesinger was pushing Beans to be their new star to replace Buddy. That wasn't working out. But Avery liked this speech impedimented pig character. He knew he could have some fun with that. Not with the impediment, but he loves having these characters that are like, that you can have a lot of fun around them. You know, Droopy was being a later version of that. He was the first to admit that he wasn't a star maker, even though he did make stars. Right. But he would say that's not his thing. His thing were the gags. The gags in the film were the thing.
And some of his very best cartoons do not have a central character.
Oh, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of these great MGMs that are, I mean, all of them are, you know, mainly, well, not all of them, but most of them are one-shot ideas. And, you know, Bad Luck Blackie, King Size Canary, I mean, on and on and on. So many good ones. So to get back to that, he's at Schlesinger's, and he's got pretty much a free reign, doing some amazing things. He's one of his first cartoons is Page Miss Glory, which is nothing like his later stuff.
Which is nothing like anything.
Right,
I
it's
love
nothing
it.
Like they do there. But it really shows what a great director he was right away. One of my favorite bits in a Warner cartoon, I've said this one of the documentaries for the Golden Collections, was, I'm forgetting which cartoon it was. I think it was Detouring America, I think, where he split screens between, he's going to show us this deadly Gila monster or something like that. And then, but for the kids, we're going to have, you know, Shirley Temple, a little girl reciting something. And the gag is, of course, the Gila monster is afraid of a little girl. But what I love about that gag is it tells us who the audience for the cartoons were, grown-ups and kids.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's one of the rare acknowledgments of that. He would also throw in these gags with like the striptease, you know, of the lizard shedding its skin.
Right.
His stuff always borderlined on the naughty, and he loved making fun of the other films in the theater. He was the SNL, the Mad Magazine before those things.
Right.
He was making fun of the travelogues and the newsreels and the other, and even the Disney cartoons, and going, you know, that was like his real thing. Now, what got him in trouble, we want to go at Warner's, yeah, and to bring him to MGM was by the 40s. Now, he's considered one of the creators of Bugs Bunny,
right,
even then.
And we have to say that from the and studio death. Vantage point, the studio has a particular view of this, that Bugs Bunny's 80th anniversary is this year.
Yeah.
Because the studio's view is a wild hare is the first Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Right.
And that is the first cartoon where Bugs sounds like Bugs, comes out of a hole, sees Elmer, who doesn't quite look like Elmer as we came to know him, and says, "What's up, Doc?" And so, despite the other cartoons that came before, which right. we won't talk about, the first Bugs Bunny cartoon is a wild hare directed by Tex Avery.
Maybe we'll, I'm not saying you're going to, but maybe we'll have a Bugs Bunny, was it 80th birthday podcast later, or maybe not.
The thing that's really great is that it is true that though the archetypal Bugs plot points and, you know, Bugs versus Elmer and What's Up, Doc, and, you know, him having fun at the expense of Elmer.
Right.
It's set up in that cartoon, and it goes on from there.
It's, the word is crystallized. It's all crystallized in that cartoon. And, of course, Arthur Q. Bryan as Elmer, Mel doing that Bronx Brooklyn thing. You know, you can see why they consider that the first one.
Because some of the other cartoons, the voice that was used for the rabbit character sounded an awful lot like Goofy. I mean, it's just an awful voice.
Well, so Avery is like kind of the leader of the Bugs Bunny cartoons of that time. The other guys are all piping in with their versions of Bugs. And of course, Bugs is kind of a crystallization of all of these different takes. But Avery's is sort of the leader. So he does a cartoon, Heckling Hare, where the character is falling to his death at the end. And if you've ever seen that cartoon, he says, "Fooled you, didn't we?" Right? And then it goes into this abrupt fade out and end. And you just know something's cut out. And that's missing footage. We've been looking for it for years.
Forever.
You know, scouring all the vaults. And the trades did not cover animation back in those days like they do today.
Oh, God, no.
And hardly at all. But Tex and that edit and him being on suspended for, apparently the story is that the cartoon didn't end there and that Bugs and the dog fall off another cliff. And that Schlesinger, who normally kept out of these things, let his boys do whatever, this was their biggest star and he's killing them again. You know, apparently that was too much. He wanted it to end on a more upbeat note there. And apparently, whatever they came to, there was one other issue as well, which I'll get to. And that led to a suspension, which made the trades. It was in Hollywood Reporter and Variety. Tex Avery, suspended. You know, suspended is what happened. Now, the other thing was, Avery loved doing those cartoons, like Farm Frolics, where we pan across we have the narrator, and we pan across the farm or the circus. And then we cut to, you know, an animal, and we hear about how wonderful he is. And then, of course, the animal looks at us and goes, "I don't care what you say, I'm cold." You know, something like that, right? And that was like, Avery thought that was the funniest thing. In fact, Avery wanted to take that to the next level. And he went to Schlesinger and said, "I want to do this with real animals. I want to do it live action." And Schlesinger was like, we don't do that. And basically, so that soured Avery on Schlesinger. And then I think this other gag soured Schlesinger on Avery, and I think that's why things came to a head. As you may know, Avery on suspension took his live-action farm animal idea over to Paramount, Jerry Fairbanks, and they made shorts, which became known as Speaking of Animals. Right. I think one of them, maybe one of the first ones, was nominated for an Academy Award. I don't think it won. I don't know. I'd have to look it up. But I don't think it won, but it was nominated. And that series lasted like 4 or 5 years. It's hard to believe it would go on so long. Meanwhile, after the first three, Avery entertained an offer from MGM. And I think the story is that Tex called up Friz, that you were there. How was it? And Friz said, "No, it was really good. It was really good. I just like it here, you know, and if you're having an issue, maybe you'd like it there, you know." And so he encouraged him to try it. So he did, and
the rest is history.
The rest is history. I noticed that the first, I think, two Avery MGMs, he gets poster credit. Now, if you see those posters that they made, those ugly
right. cartoon an posters. MGM cartoon, yeah.
Right, but only the first two, it says on in big letters, directed by Tex Avery. It must have been part of his contract. It didn't last more than two cartoons, but I find that interesting. It must have been contractual.
But the real breakthrough cartoon happened about three cartoons in, right?
Three or so cartoons in, Avery decided to continue on with the spoofing of the fairy tales. I mean, he had done a cartoon at Warner's called Little Red Walking Hood.
Right.
But that was kind of
that
normal.
That is pale in comparison.
Right. Well, he was with the times. He was with it. That's the one of the great things about Tex Avery, and you'll see this on that set. Avery was funny as heck in the 30s, perfectly placed in the 40s, of which these Red Hot Riding Hood cartoons and others attest. But man, didn't miss anything in the 50s
no.
when he's doing stuff like Symphony and Slang
right.
and others, you know, when he's got the 50s style. Who cares? It's hilarious.
I mean, like even the later things, which we haven't released yet, like Flea Circus. I mean, like
Flea Circus. I'm thinking
very
of
50s.
Field and Scream and some of these ones that have that real UPA look to them.
Right.
You know, and yet they look contemporary, and they're hilarious.
So the cartoon that we're alluding to is Red Hot Riding Hood.
Yes.
And I just want to say, as a kid, you know, these MGM cartoons weren't really seen on TV, and then they reappeared. And I remember the first time I saw Red Hot Riding Hood. I still remember it to this day, the first time I saw this cartoon, and what a mind-blowing cartoon it was. I mean, I was just like, what was that? That was amazing. And then I started trying to find more, which wasn't easy then.
And it didn't have a character. Or, well, you recognize the wolf and Little Red Riding Hood. But as a kid, you were like, this is Tom and Jerry. This is Bugs Bunny. You know, and then this stood on its own, which was not, at least when I was a kid, not how they marketed animation.
It was supposed to be a one-shot cartoon, and the chemistry of that cartoon ended up being repeated probably, four or five times?
Not only four or five times, but every studio in town made
a
ripoff cartoon of it. Everybody did.
And who would think
sort of
that
thing?
Four decades later there'd be a ripoff feature film?
Well, it was an homage. I think they'd like to
say. Loving homage.
A loving homage.
And I think a turning point for the popularity of Avery.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, that movie, which we're alluding to, is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which used Droopy, of course. Droopy practically became a reborn star.
You know, the power of Spielberg being the producer of that film enabled everyone's IP to be in the one film produced by the now defunct Touchstone Pictures, which was Disney's attempt to make live-action adult films. It seems like forever ago, but it wasn't that long ago. But what I'm trying to remember is when I started my career in home video, it was really important to me to bring Tex Avery cartoons out on VHS and Beta.
I'll precede you slightly, and then I know where you're going with cartoon movie stars. But as you know, when I was over at MGM UA, my latter days there in the 16 millimeter department, somebody stuck their head in asking about the cartoons. They had seen my catalog, and they wanted to put some MGM cartoons. They wanted to do something with cartoons. And I was able to program that MGM cartoon magic. Remember that?
Yes.
And so that was their first toe in the water, you know, of any of that. And I'm kind of proud of that because I had to select very judiciously. I wanted a Barney Bear. I wanted a lot of Tex Avery. I wanted one or two Happy Harmonies. I just wanted it to be no Tom and Jerry. It was just the other things.
Right.
Anyway, I'm kind of happy.
Tom and Jerry Volume 2 had come out by that time, too, I think.
Did it?
Yeah. And that was long before I was there. And when I did get to the company, it was the idea of, okay, cartoons are not just for kids. And these need to be treated as films that were made for adult audiences that were fine for children to see, but they needed to be sold that way. And that was why we developed the Cartoon Movie Stars line at MGM UA Home Video. And along with selling Bugs and Daffy and so forth and so on, and Tom and Jerry, we did Tex Avery Screwball Classics Volume 1, and everybody looked at me cross-eyed like, who the hell is Tex Avery?
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, he's a ball player, you know, like, yeah, like, who is this guy? And when we put out the first volume, the response was thunderous. It was enormous, and it led to several more VHS collections, and then years later, what was intended to be a comprehensive full collection of all the cartoons. The problem was we were not provided with unedited masters by the company that actually owned them at the time. Oh. And so the Laserdiscs went out with some cartoons edited and also plagued by the evil DVNR, digital video noise reduction, which eliminated a lot of the animation. And most of those masters are, until now, what have circulated on television and in other media because nobody had really attempted the Averys. Now, Tex Avery is probably as popular in France as The Simpsons are here and have been that way for decades.
Right.
And I don't know quite what is responsible for the French success and knowledge. There's that phenomenal book that Patrick Brion wrote.
That book came out in response to its popularity.
Right.
I visited France.
It wasn't because of his book that it became popular, but I'm saying because of the popularity of those cartoons there, I don't know what was the trigger that made them popular there and basically relatively unknown here.
Yeah, I don't know other than that's something to research. That's something I would like to do, actually, because I'd like to know, does it stem out of the theatrical days or was it something out of the TV showings? But clearly the visual sense, you know how they love Jerry Lewis.
Right.
I mean, and of course, Jerry Lewis being a disciple of Frank Tashlin, very similar to Tex Avery, but they love that visual, humor just appeals to them. A funny thing, I was talking to a guy there's a playwright in Europe writing a play about Fred Quimby.
Oh, right.
Did you hear this?
This is crazy because I was like, the guy had nothing to do with the actual
cartoons. They think Fred Quimby.
I know.
Is the guy,
in
the mastermind
Europe,
behind these cartoons.
This is also in England, the same thing.
Yeah.
He has a great signature.
Right. And I kept having to explain to people, it was like, no.
Right.
He was basically a bean counter.
Yeah.
He didn't have anything to do with the creative creation of the cartoons. He was an executive that was responsible for the unit. It's just like Pete Smith was the head of the MGM Shorts unit, except he was creative.
Yeah.
And he was able to straddle both arenas.
Right.
In any event, the popularity of Tex Avery really kind of came to a head with this kind of the energy of the home video releases, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, saying, where did Jessica Rabbit come from? Oh, it was inspired by the cartoons of Tex Avery. Suddenly they were available on video. And
there was another, this might have been a little bit later, but remember that movie, The Mask?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Well, they show the Tex Avery VHS.
That's right.
That they did in that movie. And I remember them sending over the letter, you know, asking for permission to put the video box in the movie. And I was like, of course, we love it. Right. And ironically, that was before Turner bought New Line. And Turner had already bought the pre-86 MGM library, you know, so it was just a weird kind of, because everything would eventually come together under Warner ownership within 2-3 years. But in any event, there is a boxed set, a beautiful tin of Tex Avery DVDs that was put out in France in 2002. And unfortunately, it was the same edited masters, censored. It was such a beautiful package with pencil drawings, and they even licensed Avery's Crazy Mix-Up Pup from Universal. It's meant to be such a comprehensive package, and I still think it's sold today. But what I have been trying to do within the company for many years is to get all the efforts together to have these cartoons properly remastered and put together, and my goal was to redo what that set was properly.
The right way.
With the cartoons uncensored and the goal was to do so chronologically, and the cost to do that was enormous. And the reason we did the Droopy DVD set was to test the waters, because Droopy was the best-known star of the Tex Avery cartoons, and if that did well, then we would be able to tackle the other Tex Avery cartoons. And the Droopy set did not do as well as people had hoped, and so the plans for an Avery set fell through. Until now. So this brings us to our release and why we're here today. I know I'm kind of jumping.
But is that why we're here?
The reason is that because there is an effort within the studio to right the wrongs of the past and preserve the features, the shorts, the cartoons, the travelogues, start scanning everything for preservation that we can get our hands on so that we can provide the highest quality, whether it be a feature film starring a superstar that won Academy Awards, or it's a travelogue that you could only see in 60mm black and white, although it was made in color. All sorts of things are being done, and we're just seeing the beginning of this in terms of what we're able to bring to the public and our Blu-ray releases. And the Popeye restorations are part of that program, and we decided to take a pause on Popeye and put the focus on Tex Avery. The reason why the set is not chronological or comprehensive is we're still looking for best film elements, and we're making worldwide searches, and we're going to other archives outside the United States to see if there are elements at the British Film Institute or the French Cinematheque or in Belgium or in Italy or wherever, because where we don't have the original negatives anymore, we have to look for something better. And if what we have is the best that can be had, then we have to make it look as good as we can. And so the result of these efforts, while not chronological, are assembled here so that we could get this to the public as a starter set. And there are some superstar best of Tex Avery cartoons in here, as well as some lesser known, in order to give people a taste of what's to come with future volumes. And if this sells well, there will be future volumes. I am very confident it will sell well. You know, the goal is, you know, I would love to see us be able to spread this beyond Tex to, you know, Jerry's eyes are lighting up because you know where I'm going. I'm talking about, you know, even the Happy Harmonies, all of our animated holdings. There's a lot of great stuff in store for the consumer who doesn't even know some of the fun stuff that we have planned. This collection is I think a lovely overview of the Avery oeuvre at MGM, and contains some of the most famous cartoons. And people will see similarities in the themes, and they will also see really wonderful story. It was primarily a guy named Heck Allen who contributed the stories to the Tex Avery cartoons. And they would all collaborate together. You know, you look at, I always laugh at the credit for Trig Brown as film editor on the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies, because he wasn't actually a film editor, was he?
He was the guy that
he came up with sound effects, right. But they didn't know how to credit him, so they credited him as film editor. Warner Brothers cartoons would not be Warner Brothers cartoons without the contribution of Trig Brown and how everybody collaborated on those cartoons and the music of Carl Stalling. Similarly, at MGM, the contributions of animators like Michael Law, who would eventually end up directing some Droopy cartoons, story writer Heck Allen, and the amazing music of Scott Bradley, which unified through Tex Avery as well as Tom and Jerry cartoons. All the MGM cartoons had music by Scott Bradley. And just as Carl Stalling made great use of Warner Brothers' own music, Scott Bradley made great use of MGM-owned music. So you'd see lots of cartoons using the trolley song in the background. And that's a wonderful unification. Very different styles between the Hanna and Barbera created Tom and Jerry cartoons and the Tex Avery created cartoons. And yet there's a unification in the Scott Bradley music.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm happy to say I assisted in the creation of a CD set that came out many years ago of the music that's called all this and Tex Avery 2. You know, it's
right.
Tom and Jerry and Tex Avery 2, I think, is the name of it. But my friend Lucas Kendall, who ran Film Score Monthly and still runs it as a website, but he did the Film Score Monthly CDs, and he put together a wonderful Scott Bradley CD collection. But yeah. Prior to that,
yes.
There was this crazy, like, single CD and cassette thing that came out with Tex Avery music that yeah. was put together by I don't know who.
Yeah.
And it was all done legally licensed yeah. from, I believe, Turner, because it was from the time before Warner Brothers bought Turner. But the music in these cartoons is integral, just oh, like yeah. the visuals. And this is full animation as opposed to the limited animation that grew out of the television era
right.
and that Bill and Joe perfected when they started Hanna-Barbera and the MGM cartoon department was shut down. But these 19 cartoons are really a wonderful starter kit if someone hasn't been exposed to Tex Avery's animated work, to see them with new 4K scans that have been meticulously remastered and cleaned up with beautiful color and wonderful sound. It's really the ideal way for people to get their introduction to one of the greatest animators of all time.
So this is a Blu-ray set, as clearly we've been discussing, but people have been asking online whether or not we are going to make this available on DVD.
I was about to allude to that okay. before, and I got off track. What I didn't expect was that there'd be such an overwhelming demand for DVD because Blu-ray players are so incredibly inexpensive. How could anybody not have a Blu-ray player? Well, apparently there are a lot of people that don't. And so for those who only have DVD, we will be coming out with a volume one of the Tex Avery set eventually, and the plan is to do it when hopefully we're releasing volume two of the next Blu-ray.
But you really should just buy a Blu-ray player and watch the Blu-ray.
That would be our recommendation.
If you're listening to this, yeah, please.
As a late adopter to Blu-ray, which I've had one now for years, but I remember one of my hesitations was, nobody ever said this, and I'm going to say it, which is Blu-ray players play DVDs.
Right.
And I didn't know that. And I think that people don't have a Blu-ray player don't think, well, what am I going to do with my DVDs? It plays them perfectly. You know?
Yeah, it actually upconverts them. Right. And
it plays them better.
One film buff explained his reticence to get a Blu-ray, and it turned out it's because he was eking out the last legs of his television's existence, and once he got a modern TV, then he was going to change. And I was like, oh, well, that actually makes sense then.
Of course, because TVs are so expensive today.
It's a whole nother story.
Now, people need to be able to see these great things that they've collected over the years. And indeed, there are movies that came out on video cassette that still haven't made it to disc of right. any form.
Right.
I just want to just add, I know we had talked about it earlier, but when you said $60 in 1980, you know, you think that's a lot. I just used the inflation calculator on that.
And?
It's $160.
That sounds about oh,
yeah.
right.
That's felt, like what people like paid. Like yeah.
It was meant to be rented, Matthew.
I know, but right. like, could you imagine paying like over
oh, I think these guys can imagine.
I remember, what was that store? Yeah, what was I that mean, store? Video Shack? Right, on 50th and like 7th and 50th, yeah, or Broadway and 50th.
Next to the Rivoli.
Right, next to the Rivoli Theater. And it was like a little museum because you'd walk in and see these glass cases of these VHSs for sale, and I couldn't afford them.
No,
you know?
I couldn't either.
But there was one with Terry Toons from Magnetic Video. Right. And
they had Allied Artists videos.
Yeah.
Allied Artists, before they went bankrupt, actually started a video cassette division.
Wow.
And put out some movies that to this day are still not available on home video.
Wow.
But we're working to change that.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
But in any event, Jerry, we're going to have to say goodbye because our time is running out. We want to thank you for taking time out of your day to join us here at Warner Brothers to celebrate the Blu-ray release from the Warner Archive Collection of Tex Avery Screwball Classics Volume 1.
Now, should we bother quickly running down the contents?
I think we should mention the cartoons by all means.
All right. Tex Avery Screwball Classics Volume 1 will contain, or does contain.
Does contain. It's in Jerry's hand.
Yeah. Red Hot Riding Hood, Who Killed Who, What's Buzzin' Buzzard, Batty Baseball, The Hick Chick, Bad Luck Blackie, Garden Gopher, The Peachy Cobbler, Symphony in Slang, Screwball Squirrel, The Screwy Truant, Big Heel Watha, Lonesome Lenny, Hound Hunters, Red Hot Rangers, Dumbhounded, Wags to Riches, The Chump Champ, and Daredevil Droopy.
Thank you, George, for shepherding this and making this happen.
And thank you, Jerry, for your inestimable guidance through all of these projects that we've been doing together for a very long time.
Yeah.
None of it would be possible without you. We also want to thank our fans for their support. It was your support of Porky Pig and your support of Popeye that helped us get to Tex Avery. So help us continue the fight and the battle to bring you animation the right way for you, the collector and the enthusiast, with the best possible quality at wonderful bit rates on beautiful Blu-rays. And on that lovely note, I would like to thank you all for listening to this podcast. Until the next time, I'm George Feltenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
I'm D.W. Ferranti. Hold on to your hats, folks.
Look forward to the next Warner Archive podcast.